I got to get up. That's fun. That's fun. I'm Wendell. I'm living love by God, figuring out what that means. And some days I got it figured out, and some days I don't have a clue. I'm recovering from spiritual and emotional abuse and addiction to food and work and control. I've had severe control issues. And I've had issues with pornography, with alcoholism, with panic and rage and depression. You know, it's just, I just got to stop and say this. None of us make it out of this alive. I guess we figured that out. None of us, you know, make it out alive. It is so cool to look death in the face and laugh and sing a song like that and just say, go ahead, death, give us your best shot, because it ain't going to work. It ain't going to work. We're eternal spirits who live in physical bodies, and these physical bodies get worn out. But, man, life just gets started right about then. And, I mean, if we don't have that, we don't have hope. You know, that's our hope. And we got a lot of people, a lot of skeptics these days that are saying, well, I don't know if there's any such thing as life after death. Well, yeah, I'm feeling it pretty strong. There's life after death. And that's just a start, not an end. It's a start. So, whew, got to come down and talk about something practical. And we're right in the middle of a set of studies on codependency. And we've got two groups that meet, staff groups that meet during the day, and we got two groups that meet on Thursday nights here. And in the fall, we're going to have three more groups start up that are just by invitation only. We're sneaky. We're asking people. They don't know what they're getting into. They think it's a dance class. Some men from Greenwood, and we're sneaky. We're inviting them, and they don't know what they're getting into. But we're going to hit them with recovery and hit them with what we have here. And we're all about honesty, right? We're going to tell them right up front what we're about. It's a dance class, guys. So we'll see how that goes. So we're talking about codependency. And one of the principles that we've talked in here a lot about is that in human beings, the pendulum never stops in the middle. That whatever extreme life takes us to, and we realize that's not healthy, that's not good, the pendulum starts swinging back. We would love for it to stop right at balanced, good, and healthy, but it never does. Because the momentum of the pendulum always swings to the other extreme. And so when we were growing up, none of us had perfect caregivers. Some of us had better homes than others, but none of us had perfect caregivers. Whether they meant to or not, they deprived us of things we needed. They lied to us, whether they meant to or not. They lied to us. Some of them abused us. So none of us had perfect caregivers. And when you're little, you need those things. You need those things when you're little. And when you don't get them, it causes all kinds of pain. And so when you wake up in your teens, in your 20s, 30s, whenever it is, and you say, that hurt, and I want to correct that, I'm going to swing the pendulum far toward health, it never stops in the middle. It always goes too far, and we wind up overcompensating, over-medicating, over-treating, overthinking, overfeeling, over-expecting, whatever word you want to put there. We wind up clear over here, and then we realize my life is messed up. I need some help, and so we come to Pathway. And so now we figure out together how do we find health. And so right now we're going to talk about three different ways that codependency manifests itself. And I know that I don't have complete agreement here. I don't care. I know I'm right. And this is not part of my control issues. We are all addicts, period. We are all addicts. I know that for sure. And I know for sure that we're all codependent. So I'm going to say those things. And people say, no, I'm not codependent. The fact that you said that probably indicates you are. We are all codependent. And we are all addicts. And so we're just going to look at three more aspects of codependency. And this comes under the heading of striving to be more. But, you know, here we go. Being in the middle and being just me is not enough. I want to be more. So the pendulum swings over here. So Here's number one. The chronic and the nagging need for attention. It just bugs the snot out of us. We've got to have attention all the time. Please look at me. Please notice me. Don't look past me. Don't look over me. Don't look around me. Please acknowledge that I exist. I don't want to just be background noise. I don't want to just be a stand-in in a movie or in a play. Just notice that I exist. I don't want to be one of your miscellaneous items. In your life, I don't want to come under that column. I've got these special people. I've got these helpful people. I've got these nurturing people. I've got these creative people. I've got these wise people. And then I've just got a little group of miscellaneous people over here. And I don't want to be one. I don't want to be in that group. I want you to at least notice me. What are we overcompensating for? When that's it, I've got. And it's normal to want attention. That's not what we're talking about. There's a normal need for human attention, sure. But this is an unusual need for attention. We're overcompensating for being overlooked, for being looked through, for being looked past. We never got picked to be on the team. Or if we did get picked, we were always the last one, you know, on the playground. They picked all the teams. Oh, yeah, they're so-and-so. Well, let's get them. Who wants them? I don't. Do you want them? No, I don't want them. Well, somebody's got to take them. So you're that person. You're overcompensating for maybe being abandoned, maybe left to fend for yourself. You may be overcompensating for being consistently this week. It is really dehumanizing to consistently neglect somebody. That's just dehumanizing. So how does it manifest itself? I need attention. I need some sort of attention. How does that manifest itself? The most obvious would be, you know, like to jump on the table and dance, look at me. But we find more subtle, civil ways to do that. So some of us get loud. Some of us get obnoxious and rude. Some of us are hyper talkers. I volunteer for that one. Joe says amen. He came and saw me yesterday. He said about 3 words. No, I let him say 5. I said something about liking talk a lot, and he said, yeah, you do. He's my brother. He can be that honest. Some of us are hyper-talkers, talk. Some of us get attention through humor. We put a humorous twist on everything. Nothing wrong with being funny, but every time it's like they're not looking at me. I'm going to think of something funny to say. Some of us become chronic liars or truth stretchers. You know, when I tell them the real version, they don't seem to pay attention, but when I stretch it, they listen for 5 minutes longer. Chronic liars. Some of us are bad boys, bad girls. Some of us are extra good boys, good girls. You know, some of us are just mean. I'm just going to be a badass. You know, and I'm going to whoop your ass to make you look at my ass. You know, and so it's, yeah, a lot of donkeys in that one. Some of us are chronically sad. It sometimes it works. If you're chronically down and sad, it gets attention. Some of us are chronically, sad. I already said hyper good boy or good girl, like really diligent, really hard workers, unusually faithful, never miss, always there. That helps get attention, because one of them, the first question was, how do you try to get attention? Everybody hated this lesson this week. Everybody did. Both staff groups and both Thursday night groups. I mean, I had profanity thrown at me from time to time. Like, you know, why did you do this? Because these are probative questions. These get down to where we live. But my answer to this one was, how do I try to get attention? And I realized that it goes back to my addiction to work, my workaholism. I'm just going to be hyper, hyper faithful, hyper diligent. I'm going to show up and I'm going to work. I'm going to work. And I'm going to work, and I'm going to work. I'm going to be the first one there. I'm going to be the last one to leave. And I don't want you to praise me. I just want you to notice me. And I think of how many calories, unnecessary calories I've burned, mental and emotional and physical, to try to get somebody to look at me and say, I see you. Really? I don't find value enough in myself. I don't find value and worth enough in myself by the way God feels about me, that I have to sweat and toil to get one person to say, man, you're a hard worker. Whew, heroin in the veins, you know. Wow, that did it for me. And I mean, There's nothing wrong with wanting to be noticed. That's a healthy thing. But when you do it the way I've always done it, that's not healthy. That's not healthy. So it's not fair for me to tell on anybody else, so I have to tell on myself. So that's the first one, attention. The second one is affirmation. Please tell me I'm worthy. I don't want you to just look at me. I want you to tell me I'm worth something. You know, find some sort of redeeming quality in me. Give me some sort of positive grade. I need you to say I'm good, please. Please say I'm good. And it'd be better if you told me I was close to the best. But I'll settle for good. What are we overcompensating for? A lot of times we're overcompensating for critical or picky caregivers. Parents who never gave you an A+ in anything you ever did. Anything you ever did, this is great, except parents who just out and out said everything you do is terrible. Why can't you do anything right? You know, sometimes we had it that strong. We may have a history of disappointing others. Some families have a whole system of hyper expectation. So in that family, if you were not a hyper performer, you didn't fit in. So if you did just an adequate average job of whatever you did, that was never good enough. It had to, you know, some families are like that. They're made up of hyper achievers. And so if you're an average achiever, what's wrong with you? So we have a history of disappointing others. We never measured up to expectations. Why can't you be like your brother? Why can't be like your younger sister? Why can't you be, you know, he's over there, he's got the same food on the table as you do, the same living situation. Yeah, he's doing this and you're only doing this. That's tough. I don't know if you came up in anything like that when you're constantly compared to somebody else. That's tough. It just takes a little while to explain, but I just love this term. It's my wife's term. When she was a teacher in Woodbury Grammar School in Middle Tennessee, that's a very small, we call it a shotgun county. I mean, if you went a month without a killing, it was like something's wrong. Somebody needs to be shot. I mean, that's just the way the county was. Not that they needed to be shot, but that was just life as normal. You could get away with murder. This is terrible to talk this way about our county of origin. But you could get away with murder in Cannon County, but don't you dare grow pot. If you grow pot, they'll have your butt in jail in a heartbeat. It was the strangest thing. You grow marijuana, boom, you're arrested. Kill somebody, yeah, you'll get off. It's not a big deal. That was a rabbit trail, Ron. Ron calls me on my rabbit trails. So anyway, she taught school in Woodbury Grammar School, and it was very cliquish. Just like any group of people is very cliquish, and grammar schools are just like everywhere. So in that town, in that school, with the teachers, but mostly with the kids whose parents were like the elite people in the town, in places that nobody else could get in. And she had this, I don't know if she thought of it. If you didn't, don't tell me because I want to be proud of you for it. She had this term she gave. She called them the Haribo group. So I thought it was just, I love that. And she would say, well, so-and-so's not a member of the Haribo group, but they're a member of the Haribo group. And so that term has always stuck with me. So you may have grown up and you were not part of the Haribo group. And you knew you weren't part of the Haribo group. But usually Haribo groups let you know that you're not part of them. They make it very clear, these are the regulations to be part of the Haribo group, and you don't meet those regulations. You know that. So it may be that you were never in the Haribo group. I'm so sorry. Man, I don't want to be in a Haribo group. So how does affirmation, the need for affirmation, tell me I'm worth something. How does this manifest itself? There's a term that comes to my mind. It crossed my radar years ago. We crow or we fish. We're crowers or we're fishers. We climb up on a stump and we start crowing. We stick the chest out and we start crowing about, this is what I've done. This is what I've accomplished. This is who, you know, I want you to think I am. So we're up there like some cocky rooster, crowing our little lungs out, trying to get noticed. That's crowing. Fishing is, I'm not very good at this. Boy, I wish I was better at this. We throw out those lures, and somebody's got to bite. Oh, no, you're good. You're good, you know. So we either fish or we crow. We do one or the other. That's a manifestation. We create needs so that we can meet them. That's going to get me affirmed. If I create a need and then I meet that need, people are going to say, wow, you're essential. We need you. You're good. We become perfectionists. We become all about image management. We got to, and so we, I mean, when we were, I was a pastor, she was a teacher. Doggone it, I hate what that did to our kids. Because there's this, and now we've apologized for this. We've gone back and made amends for it. But growing up, it's like our kids had to be a little above average because we had to maintain the image of a pastor slash teacher. And she taught for 31 years, so everybody knew her. So image management. Where am I? A lifelong ladder climber. You know, whatever rung I'm on is not high enough. Wherever position in the company I'm in is not good enough. Whatever the level of my bank account is, that's not enough. Whatever it is, I'm not pretty enough. I'm not smart enough. I'm not what. And we just keep climbing the professional ladder. If it's some sort of a musician or an artist or a writer or a performer, whatever, we keep honing our craft, trying to get better and better and better. Which, that in itself is okay. But it's this drive for affirmation that makes it kind of toxic. Constantly comparing ourselves to others. In my case, I'm not like this so much anymore, but in my case, I always felt like I had to be the alpha. Any group I was in, I had to be the alpha. Had to be the best or the leader or the, you know. And now, I don't even want that. But, so that's how it kind of manifests itself. And again, when I answered that question for myself, it was like, no, I just work really hard and hope somebody notices and somebody says, well, good job, you know, good job. Nothing wrong with hard work, but the motivation being that is what makes it unhealthy. Here's the last one. Adore me only. I will settle for nothing less than your devotion, and I don't want you to be devoted to anybody else. In the lesson, we called it monogamous adoration. I want your adoration. In the example we use, since the name of the book is Dance Moves, the example is, with you, this ain't a square dance. You're not my one of many. You're my only dance partner. And that's all I'm going to settle for. No square dancing. I don't want you dancing with anybody else in the room. Just me. And this happens male-female. It happens male-male, female-female. It happens in friendships and marriages. It happens all kind of ways. I refuse to share you. You're my one and only, not one of many. And don't look anywhere else. That's how, I just want your total devotion. And obviously, the need for attention, we all say, well, you're kind of picking at frog hairs there. I mean, do we really have to talk about that? For affirmation, we say, well, everybody needs affirmation. When we talk about this one, we're all of a sudden saying, okay, now you're talking about something that can get a little hinky. This can go bad really quick. This monogamous adoration. What are we overcompensating for in that case? These are kind of guesses in my part because I don't really find myself, I don't know that I've ever been in a relationship that was characterized by this. I might have been, but I don't think I've been. So I had to just kind of think of what have I heard, what have I observed. So you may have some other examples that are better than these. But what are we overcompensating for? We were really never seen as an individual. The only way we were ever seen was paired up with somebody else or in a group. But we were never seen in it and recognized as an individual coming up. I think I have this right. I could be wrong. But someone was taken from us at a very early age. Somebody died or somebody just abandoned us. And so our idea is that relationship was wrenched completely out of my control. It was taken away from me completely against my will. And so I'm going to find somebody and have a relationship with them, and I'm going to make sure I control every aspect of that relationship. I'm going to get a tight grip on it, and I want them to be who I want them to be. I want the relationship to be exactly like I want it to be, and I'm going to control every part of it so it stays predictable and safe. People who have lost someone at an early age, and they will latch onto somebody else in their adulthood, and they'll have this kind of relationship. It's like, you've seen that, people who have just one friend, period. That's it. That's all they care about. Or one person in their life, and that's it. That may be one of the reasons they're overcompensating for that. Sometimes it's just in the birth order. If you're the oldest of several children, you're the oldest and you got all the attention till child two came along. And all of a sudden now you've got to share the attention and life is wrenched out of your control again. So you say, no, when you get older, you say, this ain't happening again. I'm going to form one relationship where I get all of your attention. I don't have to share you with anybody. Could be that. Could be the middle one who sometimes gets ignored. Could be the youngest one where the parents are like, we've already done all our parenting. You're going to have to fend for yourself, you know. Sometimes the little one is spoiled. Sometimes the littlest one is kind of neglected, you know. And so it could be something to do with your birth order. It could have something to do with a very chaotic childhood. If you were raised in an extremely chaotic setting where life was unpredictable, you never knew when the next shoe was going to drop or where the next disaster was going to happen or the next chaos was going to sweep in the room. And so life was totally out of control, totally beyond your management of any kind. So when you get older, yes, I will control. I'm going to get one person. I'm going to control them. So we have this single person. It manifests itself with obsession, with stalking, with demanding, with hovering, with demonizing everybody else, with expecting the other person to be in lockstep with us in terms of our political ideas, our theological ideas, our everything. You know, we want... Okay, so I'm going to give you a little picture into me. This is how I answered this question, because I thought I was scot-free. I love it when I write questions and I'm scot-free. People think, well, you write these questions. You know they're coming. I forget the questions. I don't remember them. So when I open the book and start doing the lesson, it's like, oh, shoot, why did you ask that? You know, and so I read it, and I think, oh, that's got me nailed. Wendell, you stupid son of a, you know. So I have to answer my own question. It makes, and so I got to this one. I thought, okay, I'm scot-free on this one. Finally wrote one that I can wiggle out of. It doesn't get me. But then I started hearing people around the room, and I started thinking about it, and I realized, dang. So this is how it manifests itself with me. Don't know if it does with you. It manifests itself with me with scorekeeping. Relationships I have where I say, okay, I gave you five of these. I expect five in return. Six would be nice, you know. So I keep score, you know. I helped you do this. You need to help me do this. And before long, my relationship with that person becomes more of a business arrangement than it becomes a free-flowing friendship because of this obsession over keeping score. And then the other way, that came to me during the staff meeting in the middle of the day. Thursday night, this one came to me. I thought, another way this scorekeeping happens to me is I look at that person and say, okay, so you went and did this with so-and-so, and you didn't do that with me. You didn't invite me to go do that with you. You know, you went to a ball game, or you went whatever for a ride in the country. What, you didn't invite me to do that. You invited them, but you didn't invite me. So I realized that's another way that I keep score. I saw enough, got me. And this is scot-free from number three until you said those. It's like, shoot, got me. And this is, these are not out to trap us or get us, you know? And that kind of gets to the, what time is that? I can't even see. 6:56. Okay, I don't need my notes anymore anyway. This kind of, today I thought, why are we doing this? Why are we looking at codependency all over again? We've looked at it four or five different times, like in phases, and we're talking about it again. And if we're not talking about codependency, over and over and over. And I think, why are we doing that? And I almost got the feeling of, I don't even want to teach this lesson tonight. I don't, because we're talking about the same kind of stuff over and over and over and over. And then it hit me. We've studied it over and over and over, addiction and codependency, and I'm still an addict, and I'm still a codependent. And it just dawned on me what we've said so many times. What we do in Pathway is not to cure us or to fix us. What we do in Pathway is not to sprinkle pixie dust on us and make us these squeaky, clean, perfect, functioning human beings. What we do is we get honest about ourselves so that now when I exercise codependent behavior, I can see it. 15 years ago, I didn't see it. Now I can see it. And you know what I can do with it? I can seek grace for it. And now when you treat me in a codependent way, I don't spend a week holding a grudge against you. I instantly say, they're struggling with codependency just like I am. I have no grudge against them. I have no anger against them. They are hurting. And because they're hurting, I'm on the receiving end of some of that hurt. They don't mean to hurt me. Their actions toward me aren't as intentional as they are. They're trying to medicate their addiction and their codependency. And so grace, the more we do what we do in Pathway, the more we study addiction and codependency and all the other relational and emotional aspects that we look at over and over, the more it opens wide the door for grace. And I don't know about you, I don't want to show hands, but I just don't. How many of y'all keep score as much as you used to? I just don't. You know? And a lot of it is not that we're getting better. A lot of it is that the dysfunction lasts for a much shorter shelf life. If somebody looked at you tonight, if somebody got you afterwards and said, you are a sorry so-and-so. I don't even know why you're coming to Pathway. You're a loser. You need to just quit coming. If they said that to me now, it would have a much smaller memory bite or whatever in my mind than it would 10 years ago. 10 years ago, I probably wouldn't sleep for 2 or 3 nights very well. I would obsess over how I could get even with them. I would obsess over how I could somehow expose their shortcomings to other people. I mean, I would plot and scheme it. And now I think, man, that kind of hurt. But you know what? I kind of know where they're coming from. And I don't really have time to hold a grudge against them. You see what I'm saying? Life doesn't get perfect, but life gets so gracious that the flavor of it and the flow of it really, really changes. And we become more spontaneous, less predictable, more beautiful. Is that a word we could use? Because forgiveness is a beautiful thing. Reconciliation, grace is a beautiful thing. It creates beauty. Well, now, it doesn't create beauty. Life is a lot better than it was 10 or 15 years ago because we keep talking about addiction and codependency and all this stuff. And it's not because we're smarter. It's because it's busting doors wide open for grace to do what it does. So that's why we do what we do. And we have a song that we're anxious to sing. We've been wanting to sing it for weeks. Rescue Story.